as if hoping some campaign would sweep him away. When it didn't, he shifted his violin case to the other hand and continued. "Well, Professor Tan says that Sigan is one of the most impossible pieces to learn, yet you play it effortlessly." The smile that touched his lips was swift and sad. "There's a Prokofiev for two violins I'm eager to learn, and Professor Tan had an idea that you... Of course, you have your own concert to prepare for. I believe this piece might suit you perfectly. Really, it isn't boring at all. The Prokofiev for two violins, I mean. Not boring. Say yes, only if this would interest you. Or if it might please you. Well, do you want to?" How would he survive? Julie wondered. He was as firm as a beaten egg.
"I like Prokofiev."
Yu smiled. His eyes were too bright, too kind. "I'll copy the score and bring it for you tomorrow."
"Okay,"
she said. To her own surprise, she asked him, "Little Yu, what is happening now? What is happening to us?" He hadn't moved, but it felt as if he had taken a step closer to her. "It's what happens to every generation." She didn't understand. The very trees seemed to bend and hold them. "Don't you recognize it, Julie?" he asked. "I think history is not so different from music. All the different eras. Like when the Baroque ended and the Classical began, when one kind of understanding transformed into another. Our parents used to blame a person's suffering on destiny, but when traditional beliefs fell away, we began to understand the deeper reasons for society's inequalities." He was speaking nervously, as if unwinding a breathless Tchaikovsky descent. "Chairman Mao says we must defend the revolution by identifying everyone and everything that is counter-revolutionary. We students have so many fights and arguments because we are still developing our political understanding. We're teaching ourselves to think in an entirely new way, uncorrupted by the old consciousness. But the youth are capable, aren't they? Truly, I think we are more selfless than the generation before us. My father was a rightist, like yours. Maybe we can become... But it is difficult because we must struggle against ourselves, really question our motivations and ask on whose behalf we're building a more just society. He was timid, but there was no shame in his eyes. If some people say what is in their hearts and other people say what glides easily off the tongue, how can we talk to one another? We will never find common purpose. I believe in the party, of course, and I don't want to lose faith. I will never lose faith.
Yes,
Julie said.
I agree with you.
Here it was again, welling up inside her, laughter and fear. I've always known I can speak openly to you, Julie. You're not like the others. We saw what our fathers went through, so... He looked at her and nodded.
See you tomorrow.
Niu was already walking backwards, his violin case smashing against his right knee. He turned, and his green clothes faded into the sunshine. Julie watched him go, and felt a painful hammering in her heart. Why did he trust her? Whom should she trust? Her hands had no sensation, as if they were made of wood. But the notes filled her thoughts as if she were still in room 103, as if her mind had not noticed that her hands no longer moved. Up until the instant he entered Kai's room, Sparrow had convinced himself he was not going. The meeting, or as Kai called it, the study group, was not meant for someone like him. Yet, for nearly 40 minutes, Sparrow pedaled his bicycle east, turning left at Henan Middle Road, right at Haining, and finally into a kaleidoscope of smaller streets. He dismounted and walked in circles until he discovered the alleyway and a staircase into the concrete block building. On the third floor, he knocked at number 32. Kai appeared, windy-haired, even though he probably hadn't left his room. Pleasure flooded his face the moment he saw Sparrow.
"I was afraid you wouldn't find it."
Sparrow smiled as if he himself had never doubted. How small it was, and dark. A radio was placed up against the door, the volume deafening. There were shapes that could be people or could be objects, but no fan, and the room was stifling. A young woman, despite moving aside to make room for Sparrow, was still so close that he was submerged in the almond scent of her hair. Someone demanded Sparrow's ID card. Others laughed, and a young man said, "Too puny to stand up to the wind. Definitely not public security."
"Were you followed?"
And then a grandmother's prickly voice,
"He probably followed you, San Li."
Laughter. Sparrow was trembling. He could smell his own sweat.
"Just relax,"
the almond-scented girl said impatiently.
"Are you really the great composer that Kai goes on and on about?"
Before he could answer, they began talking about a book he hadn't read. He hadn't even heard of it. They mentioned a book he did know, Kang Youwei's Book of the Great Community. But the moment he silently congratulated himself, the conversation rumbled on. In the corner, Kai had not spoken. He was at least a decade younger than the men and women in this room.
"Old cat, what did you bring? Where are you?"
"In your lap."
This was the grandmother speaking now.
"San Li, pay attention to what's in your lap for once."
The grandmother reached into a cloth bag and pulled out a small stack of books.
"A few odds and ends. Essays in skepticism."
"Delightful." The almond-scented girl, whom they called Ling, purred.
"And Xi Li, on the aesthetic education of man. Shen Chongwen and what else?"
Another candle was lit. Ling picked up Xi Li, or Frederick Schiller, searching for the place they had left off the previous week. Sparrow knew Schiller only as the German writer beloved by Verdi, whose poem Brahms had used in a funeral song. "Even the beautiful must die. See, the gods weep, all the goddesses weep, because the beautiful perishes, because perfection dies. Even to be a song of lament on the loved one's lips is glorious."
San Li said, "Hurry up, the spy is dozing off."
"A birch tree, a spruce, a poplar is beautiful," Ling began. "When it climbs slenderly aloft, an oak when it grows crooked, the reason is because the latter, left to itself, loves the crooked, the former, on the contrary, loves the direct course. Which tree will the painter like most to seek out, in order to use it in a landscape? Certainly that one, which makes use of the freedom, that even with some boldness, ventures something, steps out of order, even if it must here cause a breach, and there disarrange something through its stormy interference."
She read for 30, 40 minutes, and every word was distinct. When she closed the book, the grandmother asked if she would be willing to take it away and mimeograph a new copy.
"I'm already copying my education, and the department is suspicious. Give it to San Li."
General merriment followed.
"Last time, he stuck all the pages together with syrup." "Ling found a fishbone, didn't she?"
chicken bone.
I like to leave a little something for you lot. It's the permanent revolution of Sanli's dinner.
When the laughter faded and the shiller remained unspoken for, Sparrow raised his voice. I will do it.
Well, well, Ling said. A bookish spy. Kai was right to be intrigued.
Have it ready by next week,
the old cat told him over the scattered giggling.
And don't eat with it.
Take this one, too, Sunli said. Dmitri Shostakovich, translated from Russian. It's too technical for us.
Sparrow accepted. In the darkness, the radio announcer was repeating familiar words.
Those representatives of the bourgeois who have sneaked into the party, the government, the army, and various spheres of culture, are a group of counter-revolutionary revisionists.
Bowls of peanuts and a jug of rice wine were passed from hand to hand. The older gentleman proposed a toast to lakes of wine and forests of meat. And when everyone raised their cups, the lone candle went out. Ling started humming a song he couldn't place.
My boy,
the older man said, turning to Kai.
It's been weeks since I saw you. The piano in my house grows dusty, and Ling says you never visit any more.
Why, I saw her yesterday,
Kai said, laughing.
But I'll come tomorrow, Professor.
The wine had permeated all of Sparrow's limbs, and the professor appeared round as a floating balloon as he scooted over.
Some of them we have already seen through, the radio shouted. Others we have not. Some are still trusted by us and are being trained as our successors.
Tipsily, the professor turned to Sparrow.
I've heard so much about you, comrade. If I may say so, your string octet is one of my favorite pieces of music. Such an honor to finally make your acquaintance.
Around them, conversation was breaking into smaller pieces. The professor hummed a song, Jasmine, that took Sparrow back to the tea houses of his youth. Sparrow confided that he had traveled the length of the country singing that very song.
In my youth, the professor said, I too traveled. I was conscripted by the Kuomintang. Fortunately, I managed to slip away and cross over to the Communist Army. It was a horror. The fighting, I mean. But we made this country.
He paused, thumped his knee twice softly, and said,
Afterwards, I arrived at the victory celebration in my hometown, only to be told, when the Japanese entered the town, my wife disappeared. I said to myself, many people were displaced during the aggression. If the gods are watching, I'll surely find her again.
The professor had gone to Shanghai to teach history and Western philosophy at Jiao Tong University.
Our books are full of stories of mistaken identity, star-crossed love, years of separation. Do you know the classic song, The Faraway Place? Well, you must, of course. I can't hear it without thinking that my beloved has finally returned. It's been 20 years since I last saw her, but in my mind, she's the same.
Tell him how I came to live with you,
Kai said. His voice was soft. In the darkness, it was unexpectedly near.
Ah,
the professor said.
Well, in 1960, I learned that my wife's nephew had a gift for music. I arranged a mission for him to the preparatory school of the Shanghai Conservatory.
You moved heaven and earth,
Kai said.
Well, I had fought bravely in the war. As I said, people bent their ears to me back then. In any case, That is how Jiang Kai arrived in Shanghai. He was 11 years old. It was just after the 3 years of catastrophe. I tell you, this was my first indication of the disaster that was happening there. We had shortages in Shanghai, of course, but nothing like the countryside. The professor motioned towards the window. Kai came to live with me, and in my home there was suddenly music. I was tutoring Ling at the time, and he used to follow her everywhere she went. They were inseparable. He took the erhu and held it as if the instrument could answer a confusion in his mind. The old professor played the opening notes of The Faraway Place, then smiled regretfully at Sparrow. He set the bow down. In the room, conversation had turned inward. Ling was saying, "But who loves the revolution more than we do? Who would die for it? I would. So why can't I criticize policies and still be considered a reformer within the party? Why does the party persist in believing that criticism only comes from class enemies?"
"But the Cultural Revolution, the new campaign, is about questioning the old ways of doing things," Kai said. "Renewing ourselves."
Sun Li was preemptory.
"Don't be naive. It's criticism along acceptable and correct lines."
Ling intervened. "Every work unit has to turn over a set percentage of rightists. But that's crazy, isn't it? Or maybe it's genius. Either way, it's entirely systematic." The talk murmured on, never finding a way through or an idea they could all agree on. Loosened by the wine, Sparrow's thoughts drifted. Underneath the radio and the voices, he felt concealed, as if he really were a spy. Tomorrow he would arrive at his office at the conservatory and continue his symphony. The four white walls, the plain desk, and open space in his mind. Could so spare a life be called freedom? He had been listening to Bach again. How had this composer from the West turned away from the linear and found his voice in the cyclical, in canons and fugues, in what Bach referred to as God's time, and in what the ancient Song and Tang scholars saw as the continual reiterations of the past, the turning of the wheel of history? Campaigns, revolutions themselves, arrived in waves, ending only to start again. Could Bach's limitations create another kind of freedom? Could an absence of freedom reveal the borders of their lives, their mortality, their fate? What if life and fate turned out to be the same thing? He shook the thought away. The wine was making him soft. He would have to stand up soon, find his bicycle and pedal home, and it would be up to his feet and legs to turn in circles. This room, he told himself, was an anomaly, perhaps one of many, corners of the city that had not yet been polished smooth. Zhu Li would have understood, instinctively, what troubled him. She would have seen how the professor and his friends were willing to leave their allotted space and march to the center of the stage. But all Sparrow wanted was time to sit in his room and write. He wanted to set down his music that came unstoppable, unending from his thoughts. The old cat picked up the remaining books, opened it almost halfway, and began to read grumpily. Her voice reminded him with a pang of his mother. The story was familiar to Sparrow, even though he had never encountered this book before. She read, "Grandfather smiled sympathetically, but did not tell Tui Tui what had gone in the night before. He thought to himself, 'If only you could dream on forever. Some people become the prime minister in their dreams.'" The glasses were emptied,
and the books packed away. So as not to attract attention, they left at intervals, the old cat and Ling, followed by San Li, Sparrow, and finally the professor. Kai, who was leaning against the wall by the door, touched Sparrow's arm lightly as he passed through. In the hallway, Sparrow stood listening, but instead of the professor or Kai, all he heard was the belligerent clamoring of the radio. Of all the radios in the building, the entire city, he realized, would soon be deaf, and that would be the end of his musical career. He wished that a week had already passed, and that he was at this very moment returning up the concrete stairs to Kai's room. If only he were just now lifting his hand to knock, waiting to be allowed inside. Instead of leaving, he might, at this moment, be arriving. Early the next morning, when Zhu Li entered room 103, Sigan became the only Shanghai. Hours later, she emerged humbled and electrified. The sky was blue-gray, as if it had swallowed all the Mao coats in the city. She heard Ravel, Sigan, Prokofiev, Sonata for Solo Violin No. 4, and Bach, Partita for Solo Violin No. 2, each on a separate channel, as if she were standing between three concert halls. On Qi Lu Road, cyclists seemed to branch out from the music itself. They disappeared in the fog of July sunshine. She walked east on Changde Road, and west again. A line of tricycle carts, weighed down by oil drums, creaked north, and commuters parted around them like shoals of fish, their trousers fluttering. Time slowed. A woman shouted at her to get out of the way, and a flatbed truck, crusted in mud, nearly knocked her down as it rushed by.
"Are you deaf?"
a little boy shouted. He was holding a stick for no reason. He ran away with his weapon.
"Capitalist, miss!"
A woman spat at her. But when Zhu Li turned to look back, the woman was gone. On and on she walked, until she found herself back at the conservatory once more. The courtyard and the building were deserted, as if it were spring festival and all the musicians had gone home for the holidays. Her footsteps echoed nervously in the empty hallways. She went up to Sparrow's office, but when she knocked, no one answered. On the third floor, her class, the orchestral class, appeared to be cancelled. Out of some 50 students, only 6 were present. Nobody looked up when she came in. The professor, known as Go Slow, was missing. Eventually, the other 5 students wandered off. The now empty room seemed to close in around her. An aimless inspection of her school bag revealed a copy of Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, which she had borrowed from the library days ago, and had been carrying in her school bag without realizing. Zhu Li opened it across 6 desks. The copy was dirty, smudged by pencil marks, and eraser dust. Beethoven, she knew, had never intended for this concerto to have so feudal a name as Emperor. The name had attached itself long after his death. She followed the solo piano through its accents and tumbling falls, and into the second movement, a B major dream, and sorrow extending like a paper accordion. If there was indeed an emperor in this concerto, she concluded he was not a king at all, but a man with ambitions of greatness, an emperor in his own mind, a child who once imagined a different life, but had come to see the disconnection between what he aspired to be and what he was capable of being. In 1811, when Beethoven was almost fully deaf, he performed this piano concerto, but the music that the composer heard in his mind failed to move his listeners, The performance was a disaster, and until his death, Beethoven rarely performed again. But what had mattered most in that moment, Julie wondered? The concerto in his mind, or the concerto of his audience? What mattered most in this moment? The words on the posters, or the lives of her parents of Balut and Sparrow, in suspension? The promise of Mao Zedong thought, or the day-to-day reality of New China? Which would win out? The Shanghai of Utopia, or the city of the real? She heard shouting, "Down, down, down," they chanted. Footsteps thundered into the classrooms and stairwells. Furniture crashed above her head. Julie heard the strange dislocation of piano notes. She heard hammering and laughing, and then, unmistakably, the smell of fire. She tucked the score in her bag, went out of the side door and into the courtyard, and hurried home. That night, Balut told her that she should cut her hair, that the long braid that slid against the small of her back was a symbol of vanity.
"Cut it, right to your chin," her uncle said. "Why can't you wear it like the other girls?"
Julie felt a shiver of fear, but she agreed.
"Here, I'll do it for you," he said anxiously,
a rusty pair of scissors normally used to cut chicken already lay on the table.
"No, uncle," she said. "It's too much trouble. I'll ask my mother to cut it."
"Your mother? But where is she? I've no idea where those two have gone. There hasn't been a single letter or message."
"Then I will wait."
"Today, little Julie. We must do it today."
He had lost weight and seemed to stand crookedly. His straw shoes made a weak, scraping noise against the floor.
"I will, uncle."
When he had retreated, she saw her mother's copy of the Book of Records on a chair beside the kindling, as if Balut meant to burn it. Julie picked up the cardboard box and took it to her room. On the bed, she lifted the lid. She could not stop herself from withdrawing a notebook at random and opening it. When the dreamer's refined yet passionate script moved her all over again, her parents seemed to rest in her hands, as if the novel had never been a mirror of the past, but of the present. What if Da Wei and May 4th, separated for so many years, still wandered as exiles, and this was the reason the novel could not be finished? Missing her parents, Julie followed her father's handwriting down the page. In the story, Da Wei lay awake in his New York dormitory as jazz and German lullabies crowded through the rooms. Men argued and women labored. A child wept in its newfound English, new to Da Wei as well. And he marveled at everything he might one day understand. Month after month he worked odd jobs. He repeatedly mended his cap and padded coat, thinking that soon, tomorrow, his life would be reinvented. Lonely and bored, he copied pages from the travels of Lao Chan, the only book he had carried from China until, on a desolate spring day, he ran out of paper. He sat staring at the iron beauty of the Hudson River, remembering a passage from a famous Lu Xun essay. "What's the use of copying those?" a friend had asked Lu Xun. "There's no use." "In that case, what's your reason for copying them?" "There's no reason." What was the purpose, Da Wei finally asked himself, of copying a life but erasing himself? When Julie woke, she was alone and in Shanghai once more. It was morning, but still dark, and she felt an extraordinary peace, a calm willingness to give in to the destiny of her life. Prokofiev's Violin Sonata No. 2 rang in her head as if she had been practicing in her sleep. She returned Chapter 16 to the Book of Records and hid the cardboard box beneath her bed. In the kitchen, she saw the chicken scissors on the table, and she put them in her bag. Outside, the air was wonderfully cool. She felt that everyone was awake, but no one spoke. The shutters were closed, but all the neighbors watched. The scissors made her feel strong and prepared for all eventualities. She passed a wall that was covered in meticulously flowing calligraphy. If the father is a hero, so is the son. If the father is a counter-revolutionary, the son must be a son of a bitch. Dig out the children of rightists, capitalist roaders, and counter-revolutionaries. Dig out the snakes of the old regime. Long live Chairman Mao. Long live the dictatorship of the proletariat. Long live the great proletarian cultural revolution. Prokofiev continued. The third movement now, with its poetic sweep, the violin teetering on discordant notes, while the orchestra carried on, oblivious. Prokofiev was a world-weary, cantankerous grandfather shuffling ahead of her, a celebrated pianist whose sonatas sang as if they had been written for the violin. After his return from a tour in 1938, his passport was confiscated. In the campaigns that followed, his music was denounced by the Politburo as formalist, bourgeois, and counter-revolutionary, and he never composed again. Sparrow had told her that when Prokofiev died in 1953, there were no flowers to be had, because all the city's flowers had been rounded up for Stalin's death, which had occurred a few days earlier. People had made do with paper flowers instead. Sparrow had heard it from the conductor, Li Telun, who had been studying in Moscow at the time. Because of the grandeur of Stalin's funeral, no musicians were available to play for Prokofiev, and so his family played a recording of the funeral march from Romeo and Juliet. The first 115 pages of the newspaper carried tributes to Stalin. On page 116, there was a small notice on the death of the great composer. Her long braid touched the small of her back, a pressure like her mother's hand guiding her through the invisible, ever-watching crowds. Just before dawn, Sparrow looked up to see a figure standing in the doorway of his office. He put down his pencil. Kai stepped into the light, and yet, in the same moment, seemed to disappear. In just 2 weeks since their return to the city, he had lost weight. There was a confusion in his eyes, and he appeared much older than his 17 years. "Am I disturbing you, teacher?"
"Come in."
Kai turned and looked over his shoulder. He retraced his steps, reached the door, and shut it. And the click of the lock sent a chill down Sparrow's spine. He stood up and busied himself with the thermos. The teacups clinked mildly against the table, and Kai sat down in Old Wu's chair. Old Wu had not shown up in the office for at least a month, and his desk was covered in a film of dust.
"You didn't come to class yesterday," Sparrow said.
"Did anyone come?" He lifted the cups and turned back to Kai.
"Two students."
"Let me guess," Kai said, smiling in an off-putting way. "Was it..."
"No, don't. It isn't important. Tell me how you are. I haven't seen you since, well, since a few nights ago."
"I'm fine," Kai said. "Don't I look it?" He smiled again, but this time it was warmer, meant for Sparrow. "Teacher," he said, then beginning again, "comrade, you must be the only one in the building.
Do you never rest? Isn't Julie here? What time is it? He said distractedly, standing up and coming to where Sparrow was. Around 4, I imagine. The best time for composing. It's like another world. Kai took the tea and peered out the window. When Sparrow followed his gaze, he saw only the darkness. I'm a teacher, the eldest son of a revolutionary hero, Sparrow told himself. And there's no reason for me to be afraid. Is something worrying you? He asked. No, Kai said. And then, more credibly, no, I don't think so. It's quiet tonight. He shifted, and Sparrow noticed the armband on the pianist's sleeve. Have you joined the Red Guards, then? He said, touching the red cloth. Joined? Kai said, his hand resting over top of Sparrow's. His voice was lightness itself. People like me don't join anymore. We are Red Guards, that's all. We, Kai meant, as in those with revolutionary class backgrounds. Uneasy with the subject, he searched for another, but could think only of Kai's adoptive father and his dream of a great musical community. How is Professor Fun? He said, pulling his hand back. The same, Kai said. Superior and forgiving as always, even though his students at Jiao Tong have begun denouncing him. He's convinced this campaign is a little jolt, nothing more. A few denunciations and it will all blow over. He applauds their revolutionary fervor. Kai sipped his tea and set the cup down noiselessly. Maybe he's right. He usually is. This new campaign is just beginning, Sparrow said. The professor thinks it's still 1919, and the era of new culture, Kai said bitterly, as if he had not heard him. He really thinks that he can have these open discussions just as they did back then, that everything and anything is up for debate. His position has made him naive. The worst is that he's dragging Sunli and Ling down with him. They're devoted followers. They mistakenly believe he has the ear of the party. If something happens to Ling, I'll never forgive him. The only light in the room was a candle flickering unevenly. There must be a draft, Sparrow thought, looking up into the darkened corners. I nearly had an exit visa, Kai said. But yesterday, everything fell apart. The professor arranged for me to study in Leipzig. He had arranged it through a contact in the premier's office, but it's all gone. I didn't tell you because it's not that I don't want to stay and serve the revolution. I was waiting until I had the exit visa in my pocket. It was only a matter of days. The visa was already approved. The last steps were formalities. But now, this morning, the cadre who signed my papers was denounced. They say he's going to be expelled from the party. Teacher, what if suspicion filters down to the professor and to me? The professor tells me not to worry. He says his brothers and his wife died at the hands of the Kuomintang and the Japanese. They died as revolutionary heroes, and therefore he is untouchable. It is his right, he says, to criticize the party and its policies because of his family's status. He sees nothing, hears nothing. My whole life was about to be transformed, but now, if I can't get out, what will happen to me? The pianist caught himself. He put his hands around his elbows and stood very still. I have to leave, he said more calmly now. I want the same overseas ticket that Fu Song got by sheer will and talent. It's the only thing I ever wanted. How much like Zhu Li the young pianist was, Sparrow thought numbly. How strange he had never noticed it before. They believed they could attain what the party had put beyond their reach, that they could strive and strive and go unpunished for their longings. From where had this blind ambition come? "You must take precautions," Sparrow said. His own words surprised him. Had it always come so naturally, he wondered, to speak words that didn't suit him? "Yes," Kai nodded, relieved. "I must." "Perhaps," Sparrow continued. "You should go down to your home village for a few days. In any case, classes have been suspended. Didn't you say there was a piano there? You could continue to practice. There's your concert, after all, in just a few months." "Yes," Kai said again, and then absent-mindedly, "I'll play Beethoven, of course. Concerto number 1. Or, well, I don't know, number 5. I've always preferred the later works. But do you think number 5 is too full of sentiment? The second movement worries me."
He hummed a few bars and stopped, contemplating.
Kai had cut his hair. It was close-cropped now, accentuating the graceful line of his neck. Sparrow glanced out the window again, fearful that someone was watching them. There was nothing. "I've interrupted you," Kai said, shifting closer. His eyes seemed perilously bright. "I've come with all my problems as usual, and here you are, always working. You're the only one I know whose attachment to music is completely pure."
"You're the one who deserves to go abroad."
"No," Sparrow said. He didn't know how to answer.
"It's no interruption. Actually, I was thinking of you."
His Symphony No. 3 lay on his desk, the first 3 movements taped roughly together, beside a copy of Chapter 17 of the Book of Records. His pencil had rolled off the table and now lay on the floor. Sparrow picked it up and placed it carefully across the pages.
"Teacher Sparrow, we rely on each other, don't we? Even though we don't judge things the same way, we understand one another. I don't know when I began to trust you. I know we're the same."
Sparrow had stepped to the side, opening a distance between them. He kept turning away out of shyness and confusion.
"I know I must sound selfish to you," Kai said. "I'm honestly worried about the professor. So many people have come and gone from his study groups, and everyone knows his views. He takes no pains to hide them. He says things that could be misunderstood, and he's blind to the consequences."
On the desk, the pencil was rolling from side to side, as if in the gutter of the sidewalk.
Sparrow put his hands down to still it.
"I'd like to hear those pieces you mentioned," he said. "It's been so long since I properly listened to them."
He went to Old Wu's record player and picked out Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5.
He knelt down, lifted the plastic lid, and shifted the record from its cover. The disc, a recording made by Glenn Gould, conducted by Leopold Stokowski, was in near-perfect condition. He had not listened to it in some time. Kai had picked up Chapter 17 and was reading the first page. Sparrow set the needle down as carefully as if he was setting it in the palm of a child's hand. At a very early age, Sparrow thought, his mind rambling, he had known that he would not be a performer. He did not have the genius of interpretation, even if he played well enough. Sparrow's gifts were of a different temperament. There was music inside him. It was as simple, inexplicable, and exhilarating as that. Music overflowed from everything he saw. If it ended, he would have no idea how to make sense of the world. The record began to spin, and the first sound was the sound of air.
This was a room in America, he thought. Perhaps a studio or a concert hall. Perhaps, he thought, technology was what had made Zhu Li and Kai both naive and ambitious. They had grown up kneeling before record players and radios. They had been lulled into believing there were no barriers between themselves and the sound itself. The ubiquity of recording had made them all equal. They heard the same recording that Gould himself listened to when he placed the record on a turntable. They heard what an American, or a Frenchman, or a German heard. Geography, ethnicity, or nationality were not the determining factors. The degree of your listening was not what set your experience apart. Your intimacy with music was all that mattered. Your attentiveness, and your desire. But was it true? What if true understanding was something innate, something they could never attain? The music began, the first heroic chords. There were days in my life, he thought, that I passed over, as though they were nothing. And there are moments, seconds, when everything comes into focus. Kai was sitting beside him now, still holding the notebook. Sparrow distracted himself by thinking about Bach. Between the thousands of pieces the composer left behind, had Bach ever known silence? Surely never. How was it possible for Bach to feel so much and not to shy away from it? But in my life, Sparrow thought, I think there is a quiet coming now. He felt so certain of it that a sharp pain spread across his chest. A deep silence was about to arrive. How could he live with it?
Chairman Mao is right,
Kai was saying.
Somewhere along the way, the ideas of the older generation became corrupted. People like the professor started off wanting to build a just society, but then they got comfortable. They became decadent and felt they'd given up enough, and the rules applied to everyone but them. So what are we supposed to do? Everything they've taught me contradicts itself. Maybe they told more lies than truth.
What the party wants is always changing, Sparrow said quietly.
I don't agree. Either we accept the old world, where we as a nation are weak and humiliated, or we try again and make a better country. I know how unjust it was. Sometimes I think I have no right to be here. I ask myself why I alone among my family was saved. What about my sisters, my parents? Weren't they equal citizens? When justice shifts, nobody can be left as they were. Isn't that so? Hasn't Chairman Mao always seen much further than we are able to?
They were sitting as near to one another as possible without touching. The music filled the space between them, its motifs turning over as if the composer had no conclusion, only movements that came around in a spiral, rising each time to a new beginning, but an old place.
Is this a novel?
Kai said, returning chapter 17 to him.
It's a story that's been in my family for years.
The notebook was so worn, and the weight utterly familiar in Sparrow's hand.
Do you think I could read it one day?
Sparrow nodded. Kai continued as if speaking to himself.
Not now, but one day, that's what I hope for. I wasn't trying to flatter you, Sparrow. A talent like yours comes along only once in a generation. You must finish your Symphony No. 3, no matter what happens.
At some point, they fell asleep on the floor. He woke to the heaviness of Kai's arm over him. It was hot, and sometime in the night, Kai had taken off his shirt and now lay half undressed beside him. How thin he had grown! Kai held him tightly, his mouth against Sparrow's neck, his breathing calm and undisturbed, but he was not asleep. Sparrow lay on his back and let his hand drift down to cover Kai's. The pianist caressed him, tentatively at first, and then with greater confidence. Sparrow's hand followed Kai's hand, and an unbearable heat settled deep into his body. They lay together, frightened, half wishing sleep would come and take them, and release them from this aching, intolerable yearning. They drifted and woke and held one another, and in the fitfulness of Kai's touch, he felt as loved as he had ever felt. The first wash of dawn arrived, without his noticing. That evening, the study group met in the old cat's apartment, located in a twisting lane on the northwest side of the city. Sparrow had been pleased when, in the afternoon, Kai came to the laneway house to remind him of the meeting. He had been surprised when Kai invited Zhu Li as well, though not as surprised as his cousin. Zhu Li, blushing, had agreed. They were the last to arrive. Just as before, the group assessed his clothing. Did you trip and fall into the Huangpu River? And manner. Nervous, as if he has thorns in his shoes. To Zhu Li, on the other hand, they were welcoming, even familial.
Welcome, welcome, the old cat shouted. No need to be so formal. Just called me Old Cat. Everyone does.
Kai greeted them both, but his eyes stayed fixed on Zhu Li, who seemed oblivious of him. He had removed the armband of the Red Guards.
I used to own the Perilous Heights bookshop on Suzhou Creek Road, the old cat said, splashing tea into a bowl and slapping it down in front of Zhu Li. But during the anti-rightist campaign, the government was banning titles left and right. There was so much overthrowing going on, I couldn't take it. Hell, I'm 50 years old, a relic. Overthrow me too hard and I won't get up. So, in 1955, I closed the shop and moved everything here.
But to keep so many books, Zhu Li said. Aren't you worried about busybodies?
What can I do? The pages are absorbent. I need them to soundproof my walls.
A tray of cigarettes was passed around. As smoke floated through the air, conversations stilled. They began to concentrate. The professor read aloud from the most battered book Sparrow had ever seen. The book turned out to be a play. Part one of Guo Mo Ruo's translation of Faust. Time dissolved. Sparrow, who knew only Guinaud's opera, at first felt in familiar territory, but then he realized he had never met this Faust at all. The German Faust chafes against his condition. This Faust was seeking a freedom within the mind that would expand his spirit as well as his intellect, so that both could attain their most divine state. But what if the truths of the mind and the soul were not merely different, but incompatible? In me there are two souls, alas, and their division tears my life in two. Zhu Li leaned towards the professor's voice as if towards the sound of a flute. When the reading ended, Ling stretched her lovely arms up into the air and said,
I prefer the sorrows of young Werther.
That's because you're a hopeless romantic, said the old cat. Or because young Werther is like a German Sun Li, said Sun Li.
In that case, I take it back.
Ling glared at him, and then at Kai, who grinned at Sparrow, who blushed and looked at the teapot. Out of the corner of his eye, Sparrow saw Zhu Li bow her head and smile widely into a tower of books. The old cat tapped a manuscript that lay beside the professor's sandaled foot.
When this translation first came out,
Even Chairman Mao praised it. But the party has turned on Guo.
I wonder if Zhu Li is right,
Kai said, addressing the old cat.
Maybe it's time to get rid of these books. They're saying it's the anti-rightist campaign all over again.
What do you know about 55? You were just a doorstep then.
As of this month, Ling said, Khrushchev is a phony communist. The Soviets are revisionist big brothers, and all the Russian composers are out. Are you getting rid of all your Fifth Symphonies and your this and that offskies?
Kai blushed.
I never keep music. I memorize the scores and get rid of them.
Shit,
Sunli said.
I can't even remember how to get home.
Sparrow laughed and tumbled a stack of books onto Julie's lap. He tried to catch the avalanche and caused another. The old cat peered into the ruins.
Look at that, she said.
Ah, Fan's weeping over his daughter by the sea. I've been looking for those poems for 30 years.
Zhu Li plucked it from the pile and handed it to her.
And what about you?
Ling said, eyeing Sparrow.
Don't tell me you memorize everything, too.
I don't. I prefer, well, I transcribe the incorrect work into Jianpu.
He had done this for the disgraced works of Debussy, Schoenberg, and Bartok. Manuscripts written in Jianpu notation, with its easy-to-read numbers, were considered backwards and rudimentary. They aroused no suspicion. Zhu Li interrupted.
But afterwards, he really does destroy them. He burns them and leaves the ashes in a little bucket.
This is a skill we perfect from an early age,
the professor said lightly.
How to grind ideas into a fine cloud of dust.
Sun Li interrupted.
For months, this study group has been reading Schiller, Goethe, and Shen Chongwen. I'm not complaining. Really, Professor, I'm grateful, because the other entertainment on offer stinks. But maybe it's time to start reading what's right in front of us.
The old cat coughed.
Surely not. There's a new campaign, he continued. Or are we so taken with all the Germans who died 100 years ago that no one notices?
He held up a copy of Beijing Review.
For instance, why don't we study this slop bucket written by the philosophy students at Beijing University?
San Li,
the professor interrupted.
Enough.
Sparrow saw Zhu Li gripping her violin case. She looked as if she wished to leave, but was prevented from doing so by the books that had fallen into her lap.
No, let's analyze this,
Sun Li persisted. He read, All revolutionary intellectuals, now is the time to go into battle. Resolutely, thoroughly, totally, and completely wipe out all the ghosts and monsters. The leaders of Beijing University shout about strengthening the leadership, but this only exposes who they really are, saboteurs of the Cultural Revolution. We must tell you, a spider cannot stop the wheel of a cart. We will carry socialist revolution through to the end.
I would fail this kid. Resolutely, thoroughly, totally. Is she writing a thesaurus? But instead of this student being sent to remedial composition, the president of the university gets beaten up. I mean, he's an old guy, and these kids really wipe the floor with him. Now the whole university is under the boot of the Red Guards, and this manifesto is the voice of the revolution.
No need to read it aloud, the old cat said. We can hear it any time we wish on the loudspeakers. And now the conservatory students are going around smashing violins.
Sun Li laughed.
What kind of person breaks a violin.
The young aren't wrong, Kai said.